Hello, everyone. Welcome to this week's Bounty episode of the Day Zero podcast. I'm Spectre, with me is Z. Today, we have a few vulnerabilities to talk about. Not a ton, a bit of a slow week, but we do have a Ghost CMS, XSS, Clam AV bug, and this year's top 10 web hacking techniques post by Portswigger, which I believe we've covered in a few of the past years.
Yeah, we've covered past years, and I'll second what you said. This was a rough week for topics. There were some decent posts out there, but a lot of things just kind of come into that category of not being that not being interesting enough to really pull anything out to talk about. Just end up being like some relatively simple issues getting published this week, at least that I came across. As always, though, I do appreciate when people kind of suggest things to check out during the week. We have our interesting links channel in the Discord, or, you know, even I've occasionally had things DM'd to me. I do appreciate that, especially on weeks like this where I feel like just, you know, we needed kind of some better research coming out. Not to hate on like the research that come out. I mean, everything's good to put out there, but yeah, I had a hard time choosing topics for the week, is the way I'll put it. And maybe that's on me because I wasn't doing great this weekend, didn't end up streaming the podcast prep either. So maybe that is a bit on just my mental state, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's easy for stuff to miss our radar sometimes. So that's where the interesting links channel and whatnot can be very handy. So yeah, it's a good shout for weeks like this. It's great when we get some contribution there. So if you're not in our Discord already, and you do come across links occasionally that you think would be fun to talk about, yeah, feel free to link them there.
Yeah, we do go a bit beyond. Like, we try and keep things to the last week, but especially with things we miss, I'm more than willing to do kind of later coverage, especially really good topics. You know, we'll cover sometimes months late. Usually, as long as it's within the last month, it's totally fine.
All right, so getting into some of our posts. Up first, we have a post by Rhino Security Labs on a Ghost CMS stored XSS. And this was a stored XSS in the profile image functionality, which is kind of a funny area to have it, reminiscent of some of the very old like forum attacks and whatnot. Getting a bit into the background, they talk about the varying privilege levels. So in Ghost CMS, for those who haven't used it, you do have levels like contributors, who can write posts but not publish them, authors, editors, admins, and owners, which are essentially super admins that can't be deleted and can access spilling information. And each user can set a profile picture, which can include standard image formats like PNG or JPEG, but also SVG, which, yeah, as they say, it's a good place to look for XSS issues. And in the case of GoCMS, they make no attempt at sanitizing the XML coming in for SVGs. And so you can just create an SVG that contains script tags in it to execute JavaScript. And wherever that image is displayed to a victim, they can XSS them. So,
yeah, that's kind of, it was something I noticed when I was going through the topics this week. This is a simple XSS, straightforward XSS. I imagine most of our listeners are familiar with this tech. But in all of our episodes of Day Zero, I think we've only talked about like just a direct SVG with XSS in it once. I think it's only come up once, and it was in a crypto topic, like cryptocurrency smart contract stuff. And most of the discussion was around the crypto aspect and not the XSS. And so I just kind of felt like, you know, we should at least mention this once over the entirety of the podcast, because it is a very common vector to get XSS through images when they support SVG, which generally I would argue just probably don't support SVG, but, you know, you kind of have to sometimes. I mean, I get it, companies do, but then you want to filter it for the script stuff. Ghost doesn't. But yeah, the only kind of novelty here in my mind was that and vendor response, which I guess escalation, but you can get into that, Spectre.
Yeah, so we talked a little bit about this before the show. So what they call out as a potential attack here is if the owner of the site gets caught by this, which is very likely, you know, with profile images where they're displayed in a lot of different places, they could use the XSS to admin role their own user and then transfer ownership to them. And while in order to do this, they would need like the user ID, email, and admin role IDs, which are randomized, they could just send a request to this API admin user's API endpoint after being authenticated to get all that information. But so Ghost does support inserting raw HTML into posts. Z and I kind of checked this out because I wasn't sure. I couldn't remember the limitations on this. So we use Ghost a fair amount. I don't really use the raw HTML personally in posts that I've done. But yeah, wasn't sure if you could include like script tags and stuff, but you can. So you can, like, if somebody has the capability to write posts and publish them, then they kind of already have the ability to do XSS, which is why the vendor probably doesn't view it as a valid vector. And there's no official patch coming for it. But the fact that it's being done through profile images and can hit more areas, including things like the admin panel potentially, does make it a little bit more interesting. But yeah, the impact is somewhat neutered by the fact that being able to put code into pages is sort of already a supported thing in the security model, I guess.
Yeah, and kind of one important thing is the administrative panel has to be hosted on the / ghost path. So, like, usually you're going to see if it's a ghost blog, it's going to be hosted on, like, whatever that ghost domain is, / ghost, will be the admin panel because it has to be on / ghost. You can't change that. But you can configure the domain it's on. And so, while normally, I believe, like, the default way people are going to run this is you'll have the ghost admin panel on / ghost, and you'll have, like, the blog on, like, the root of the domain. And so an XSS in a post, you know, anybody who can publish can get access, they'll be able to access also that / ghost endpoint. Though you can change the domain. So even though it has to be on the / ghost, you can actually run the admin panel off of a different domain. While that might not be the most common way to do it, that would actually mean that this issue in the profile image does get displayed on the admin panel. And so it does impact the admin panel specifically. Whereas if it's just on a post where you're able to get this, post previews still only happen through the main domain, I think. I don't know. I tried. So we use Ghost as like a headless thing. We don't actually use Ghost to publish the content. So our setup is a little bit weird. But the preview domain is always going through the Ghost URL. You need to at least have the preview thing mounted, or at least access, which we don't. But either way, where I'm getting at is posts. You know, on the main website, if you have the admin on a different website, you wouldn't actually be able to access the admin API, or as they do here, the admin API, but you also won't be able to do any of that stuff. You won't be able to access like anything sensitive. You would just be accessing the blog, which isn't actually that usable for an XSS, but this image based one or SVG based one, you would actually get it on the admin panel. So you could do this inside of the admin panel, or well, inside like the content management panel. It is the admin panel, but it's not only admins who log in there. That is where like the contributors, the lower role that we talk about for this attack, would also be able to log in there. So there definitely is an impact for some setups that makes it a little bit different. Okay, so I just kind of took a look here. It looks like the admin API session token is limited to the path of like the admin API. So you wouldn't be able to access that from a, that from just a post. You would need to have that running on the admin page. And the interesting there is while you can add HTML into your post, the editor itself does not show that JavaScript.
It doesn't render it.
Yeah. And like I said, the preview works through a different path. So what they do is they make a request to the API / admin session to get the session information. So it doesn't even matter about the cookie. You just need to know what the domain is for the control panel. Yeah. Control panel is a better term than I've been saying is admin panel. Okay. So I was talking a lot about that cookie and stealing that, but you just, yes, you don't have access to it at all. Although, if the admin panel is on a different page, you can't make requests to, like, if it's on another domain, you can't make requests to this. So, yeah, you still have the impact because it's running in the admin panel. Like, that, I think, makes this one different than just XSS from the other sources that users could do, but only when it comes to these ones that are set up so as it's not running on the same domain, like the content panel isn't on the same domain.
While I don't think that would be a common setup, it's probably not super uncommon either.
Yeah, like the fact that they can be run headless is a deal. Like it is something that they're known for doing. It is why I opted for Ghost, is because they have this really nice API that lets you do some you know, nice queries. You can do, it supports, like, they have a GraphQL interface, which makes it nice for selecting just what you want or just what you care about sort of deal. And they have the standard, more RESTful API, so you can use that too. But point being that just having the XSS on the main blog isn't necessarily going to include hitting the actual website, because you can't do this fetch. Like, their attack is assuming that you're running inside of a post, I think, or inside of, like, the main URL, but this would apply to just running on the admin panel, and that's the one that would be able to make these fetches, is the one running inside the admin panel. So yeah, that does make a difference, is what I'm getting at. Roundabout way getting there, first looking at the cookie, realizing that didn't actually work out. And then yeah, this just being able to access the admin panel URL if they're on different domains would make a difference here. If they're on the same domain, this works regardless. Like, you'd be able to do this from the post based one also. But yeah, so the impact's interesting. I do think this one stands out again because it's running or because the XSS can be sourced on the / ghost endpoint, the content endpoint or content management endpoint. Like, that definitely makes a difference here. At least in my mind, it makes a difference over the impact.
Yeah, and I mean, overall, I don't really agree with the vendor not viewing it as a valid vector, just because, kind of like what you had said towards the top of the topic, I don't really think you need to support SVGs for profile images. I don't think you need vector graphics for that. It just seems like an unnecessary risk, or at least if you're going to support it, then yeah, you should be running it through like DOM Purify or something to
which is what the patch they offer. They have the patch that mitigates the issue. That just does DOM Purify. Yeah, it's a very, I don't think
it's an easy issue to fix. I don't know why the vendors would be like, yeah, no, we don't care. Like, it's not like it's a difficult vulnerability that requires re-architecting something, you know?
Yeah, so on one hand, I would say that, you know, if you have the belief that any of these users can already add scripts and can already basically do this, I kind of get the feeling of, well, we're not going to deal with this one case because they can just, you know, add the HTML through the normal interface. I kind of get that. And in terms of the SVG support, if they use kind of generic where it's not necessarily profile images, but it's just uploaded as an image. So you can do the same thing by uploading an image through the post. Like, you can click and drag an image on there and it'll actually, or you can add it as an image. They have a little thing there that you can upload the image that way too. I'm not sure if it stores them distinctly because it's a profile image or not. I don't think it actually does. Like, I think it's just their standard upload supports the SVG. And in the standard upload, I could see a reason why somebody might want that feature. Not super common, but I could see a reason why somebody might actually want to be able to, like, do some scripting on their SVG and do some stuff there.
For a regular post image, yeah.
Yes. Sure. So if it's, like, the same thing between them, I can kind of see it. And if, like, what some they don't talk about is if you could do the same sort of SVG upload with the picture upload, like, just in a post. That might also be an issue, or maybe not. They don't call it out either way. So I guess it's probably safest to assume this is just for the profile image. But again, that also comes down. The profile image will land inside of that content panel. Either way, like, I don't know. I guess it comes down to perspective. Like, I could understand a perspective on why it wouldn't get patched. I would rather see the security by default and just not have the insecure. I'd actually rather see them also strip content by default, like strip script tags out of your content by default, and then allow that to be enabled. Having that sort of option, that would be a bit more
for re-architecting.
Yeah, I'd rather see default deny on that in particular, especially because of this obvious access to the API through it. It does feel just like either securing there or securing something with the API, like having it, you know, maybe running it default elsewhere. I don't know. That doesn't feel like a good solution to me. I'd have to think about it a little bit to come with another thing about needing to go through. Well, then you'd maybe need tighter sessions. I could see some things with session management, perhaps, like keeping short sessions, so, you know, they'd have to be logged in at the time, but, and like ensuring credentials, so you have, like I think MyBB does it where you log, or PHPBB does it where you log in every time you want to access the admin panel. It doesn't like store it for very long. Maybe something along those lines, you know, could be used to mitigate it a bit, but they're not perfect solutions. I don't know. I'm just kind of talking right now about, I didn't think about this beforehand. There are some options, but
basically there's some defense in depth that could be employed for situations like this. And I think it would make sense to take steps like that. But ultimately, you know, it's up to the Ghost Foundation. So
yeah, they've made their choice. And I think their choice is defensible. I don't agree with it, but I think it is at least defensible, because these are fairly privileged people. Like, you're generally not inviting random people to be contributors on the blog. You might take a post from them and then maybe like add a user and just post, like giving them credit for it, but not actually letting them into the whole blog system. It does feel somewhat privileged off, so I understand the perspective. I disagree, but understand.
Yeah. All right, so getting into our next vulnerability, we have one detailed by Emmett Schendel and is a vuln in Clam AV, which is an open source antivirus. Z, I'll let you get into this one. Yet again, though, a fairly simple issue when it comes down to it.
The issue is quite simple, but it's also really fun because I think the most obvious way of abusing this one is through a security feature in a sense. But let's get into the issue itself. Basically, Clam AV can be run so that it's like scanning, like the antivirus engine can scan files that are coming in on, they use a mail server as their example here. It comes in and then it's going to trigger this virus event. So if it detects like malware in the mail server, and that is one of the main places I've actually seen Clam AV run, is with mail servers. I'm not sure if it like comes default with something, but you know, that's in my mind, that is one place I associate it with. And so with a virus event, it goes through the configuration. So this can be disabled, not by default, but, and it feels like the sort of thing, like if you're running Clam AV, why would you disable virus alerting? Like, I don't get why you disable it, but somebody out there must have a use case because it can be disabled. And ultimately for the issue, if you come through this virus action function, get through the C, ultimately what's happening is it's making a call. Well, it's forking and then doing an XLE bin sh call with a buffer command. That buffer command is filled doing a, just a string replace. Well, they're kind of manually doing it here, but they're putting in on both the %V, which ends up just being the virus name that they match this to, and %F is the important one. That is the file name. That is attacker controlled, and that is not sanitized. And so they create the string to be executed that then gets they create to be executed. It gets executed with attacker controlled content in it coming from the file name of the file they found it in. So an obvious way of abusing this would just be to send the ICAR string. If you're unfamiliar with ICAR, just this little test string that basically every antivirus will support. Let me open it up real quickly here. It is this ICAR test file. Now it is technically a file, but you can get this string to just be caught too. Since we're talking about like the email attack, it's just fine to do this as a file too, but it's just this very safe file that can be used. And using that, this string, you put it in your file, you send that over an email, you're going to trigger this attack. So you're kind of able to use that. You could just use a legitimate malware. You could just have some that matches any old signature, but this is the one thing you could use that you know is going to get picked up. You don't have to question whether or not they have that right signature. If anything changes, this will like always get picked up. So you can include this in your file, email this to somebody as a file, use the file name as your command injection, and just have very straightforward command injection. So yeah, not super interesting of an issue in terms of the command injection. You see it a million times, but kind of a fun scenario because it is antivirus. And it is one of those things that I think just by default, maybe it's less so now because I think people think about their antivirus a lot less now, with like Defender kind of being a default for a lot of people. And like, you're not really thinking about all these things. But I remember years ago, my first engagement with an antivirus product. And I remember thinking like, you know, this is probably going to be a hard engagement. you know, it's going to be secured. I've always been surprised by the stupid things in security products. And yeah, that goes for antivirus. That goes for other security products too. Like, it seems like security people don't write secure code. Maybe, you know, depends on who you are, but I have seen a number of really crazy issues in security products. And, you know, this just, because of that, this just doesn't surprise me that such a simple thing would exist here in an antivirus.
Antiviruses are kind of notoriously crap for,
for quality. Back with my first one, like, it wasn't notoriously crap yet. Like, this, because this was over a decade ago. It was a while ago. They were already seen as kind of crap to run and a lot of bloat, but at least in my mind, they didn't have that bad reputation just yet. But that was just for me. So, yeah, I'm not surprised by this. And, yeah, I mean, if you see antivirus on a bug bounty, take a look. You might find some stupid issues that you don't expect to.
Yeah. All right, so that is the main vulnerabilities we had for this episode. But as I mentioned at the top of the episode, we also have a Portsligger post on the top 10 web hacking techniques of 2023. Some of these, I believe, have some overlap with topics we've covered. So, yeah, Z has gone through and all the points and looked through them all. So I'll let him get into it here.
Yeah, I've gone through all, and I figure since this is kind of a lighter episode on some of the technical aspects, I'd at least talk through what most of these were, at least those that we didn't cover in depth, which there were a few. Actually, I thought it was interesting how many of this did, or how many of this list did come out during the summer. And even more interesting, there were two topics here that one was like June 16th and the other one was like June 17th. Like, they were very close in time on that too. But let's start off with number 10. Can I speak to your manager? Hacking root EPP servers to take control of zones. The interesting thing on this one was really just looking at EPP, which if you have asked me before reading this, what's EPP? I wouldn't know. It's used by, like, when you buy a domain, you want to update your whois or something. It's one of the ways that the root DNS may be set up to allow the people doing the registration or selling domains to actually interact with the root zone, like update the whois, transfer domains, or, you know, get transfer codes, do that sort of work. So it's this backend thing that's used. It's an XML-based protocol. But the vulnerabilities here, in my opinion, aren't that interesting. They kind of had two vulnerabilities in there. One was just the fact that, you know, this is XML based, so what if we include a external entity? Oh, look, it worked. They were able to dump files that way. And the other one was, it seemed like a bit wider software had an API for doing a little bit of other stuff. You can make a request to the cities thing, which has directory traversal. A straightforward directory traversal. Nothing super interesting there, but it was research from, like, Sam Curry, Brett Beerhouse, Rise Ellismore, and Subham Saya. I'm not sure on the pronunciation there. At least a few of those names I do recognize, though, as being well-known. You know, the web hackers versus the auto industry got a lot of popularity there, and that Sam Curry was on that also. I don't remember if Rise was. Either way, you know, it definitely got some popularity there. I didn't find the vulnerability super interesting, in my opinion. But it is one of those things where it's like this super deep technology is also rather fragile, but nobody looks at it. Therefore, nobody picks up on these things. And these vulnerabilities, you know, could have enabled them to. I mean, the XXE, they only show it for leaking files. But still, you know, you'd have been able to potentially, you know, leak transfer codes, take over domains that way. You know, there's a lot of potential for these bugs. And one of the things they did find out, like, you know, owning this server would have let you own the entire DNS zone. Like, I think this was AI that they found it on. So, like, all .AI domains could have been taken over or hijacked. So very impactful, despite being simple issues, very impactful work. Number 9, cookie crumbles. I was reading this one, I'm like, this is really familiar. And it turns out that on episode 229, we talked about cookie bugs from somebody else, and they cover almost the exact same issues. They have a little bit of deviation in terms of where this one goes. They have more vulnerabilities and more libraries kind of impacted. And oh no, it almost feels a little bit like they collided on the research, but even the way they cover it is in like the same order and stuff. I don't want to like claim that they stole research there, because they do also have some novelties in both of them, but it's really similar work. And it just comes down to like, you know, cookie parsing issues, kind of little edge cases with how cookies work. I thought this cookie crumbles actually hit the impact a little bit better than the other post, so definitely give it a check. I do think this is a really cool bug class for how like different servers may interpret the cookies and spoofing like host restricted cookies. Both of the posts are episode 229 talked about being able to spoof the cookies, but we didn't make the connection over how you'd apply that onto the host. They make that really clear here. It's like, oh, that's how you'd use that issue. I didn't really connect with that on the other post, but got it here. Really good. It is an academic, so it's from Usenet Security from this past year. So it is a paper, solid paper, good presentation. It's only like 12 minutes. I'd say everybody should really give it a watch, because there's some cookie issues that you can look for immediately. Really cool. One of my favorite kind of issues from the year, although we didn't get to cover this particular post. We covered the other posts that came out in May, though we covered it some months later. I thought it was really cool, and I think this paper was also. Number 8, from Akamai to F5 to NTLM with love. Cool thing there was the HTTP desync attack or request smuggling attack that was done. It was kind of like a content link zero-ish style, but it was using a malformed content link. So by malforming the header, they got to improperly be set to zero. Use like a space-preceded header. And a mismatch in parsing it, depending on what normalization was performed. Had a really cool desync in there, but we had covered that on episode 223 from November. How I Hacked Microsoft Teams got 150,000 Pwn. This one, at a glance, I'm not sure if we would have seen this one, because it did come out during the summer, during our break. And at a glance, it looks like it's your classic Electron issue. It didn't have context isolation. Therefore, any sort of XSS can potentially break out, but did actually have a couple interesting things on the XSS side. It ended up using Angular expressions, or like their kind of template stuff, rather than just a straightforward XSS to actually get it. So they had a little bit of trickery there, and had to do a bit of work to deal with sandboxing. So there are some interesting aspects to read through there, how they had to kind of navigate the object trees and prototype tree to get to something useful and get code execution. Definitely better than I thought at a glance. So if I did see this over the summer, I might have looked over it. I don't remember seeing it, to be honest, but I might have just glanced and kind of saw Electron, no context isolation, ignore the rest because I thought I knew where it was going. So kind of my bad on there, but you know, still worth a bit of a look. It is just slides with it, but the slides were relatively easy to follow and had enough information to follow. And just last week, I think it was, we were talking about HTTP response splitting issues, and I'm like, oh, you know, you don't really see this anymore. And then here, this new research, this came out during the summer, I did not see this at all, was request splitting. So not quite the same thing, but they do go request splitting, which is closer to our request smuggling sort of issue. But it's with Nginx and kind of just misconfigurations with Nginx stuff. I don't think we covered this, but absolutely worth a read. Again, it just has the slides there. This was presented at a Russian conference, so I think the only video and stuff is, I'm not even sure if the video is available, but is in Russian, but they have a English translation. Easy enough to follow here. Really good slides to follow, kind of give you the idea. And it just comes down to Nginx supports various variables that you could use in your, like, in your various directives, whatever you want to do. But some of these variables would do URL decoding of whatever was in that content. So like your path, maybe URL decoded. So you can include like the CRLF characters in there, URL encoded, of course, and the variable will have a decode. So then when it's used for like a proxy pass request or for a rewrite or something, it'll have the new line in, or have the new lines in there. And from those new lines, you can then start controlling, like, go for, like, the request smuggling or inject headers or do other things there. So, cool approach on it. Interesting to see that in Nginx and kind of being a issue that, you know, I could imagine myself making. I don't tend to do really complex rewrites or proxy pass, so Probably not.
And I could imagine it being common because for Nginx rules and stuff, a lot of that is copy-pasted. You know, a lot of like people don't really want to write Nginx rules from scratch generally, so it's pretty common to take like a Stack Overflow answer or something like that and plop that in if it works. So if there were, you know, errors made that could be exploited with CRLF injection in those rules, then they're probably applicable across a fair variety of different servers. So,
yeah, and some of it is also kind of, it's not necessarily obvious what the problem is. So they have this variables from a regex with an exclusive range. And I've just brought up one of the slides here where they show like this vulnerable case is because it has this range of characters, I believe, in there as how it's kind of doing its search, which is, then becomes vulnerable. But the dot star character being used just to match the rest of a string instead of the first one is to match the rest of the string until a slash versus just the rest of the string. Rest of the string, that's not vulnerable. But doing this is vulnerable to the issue. So like that's not something you're going to pick up really easily as, oh, that's a vulnerable issue. But it is in this case and how that kind of works. So I think it's really cool. Like, I think this is something to keep your eye out for and just to give a test because it definitely can be found. It's not actually an issue with Nginx. Like, Nginx isn't necessarily doing anything wrong here. It's an issue with that configuration, so it's going to persist for a while. Definitely something to keep an eye out for and really cool. I'm disappointed we missed covering this as one of, like, our summer. It was another summer thing, so kind of have to pull things down on that, but yeah, really cool. Number five, exploiting HTTP parser inconsistencies. This one, we gave this a shout out, but we did not actually cover. So I gave it like 4 or 5 minutes talking on the episode. Like I did talk through the core issue, but I did keep it at a very high level. So I'm going to still give it to us as, you know, we did catch this research for the year. But yeah, worth taking a look at. It just comes down to different normalization again, more desyncs. Like this has been a year of desync issues, really. There have been a ton of things coming out on that front. And it just comes down to like how different servers will trim characters is one example, how they'll do their normalization. So like they talk about, you know, one character gets removed by Python, but JavaScript doesn't remove it. So depending on your front end, back end, you have some differences between what paths are going to allow through or not. And just, you know, they kind of document a lot of the characters that can create problems between different versions of Nginx versus Flask. And yeah, cool research. I gave it the few minute talk. I just gave you kind of the high level overview there, and you can get the specific characters that have an impact from the post. What's next here? PHP filter chains. This one, I remember this one as we had this in an episode, and it was just really hard to kind of follow how this works. And it starts from a CTF, which already kind of makes me drop topics because I prefer seeing the real vulnerabilities come out and like have an actual impact. It is a cool attack using PHP filter chains. It gets hard to follow, and I had a hard time dealing with all the different encodings that uses. But the gist of this is you can, using a filter, so if you're able to get like a file included with PHP filters, even if you don't have it print the content, you can still use an error based off of using these filters to introduce different errors. You can determine what the content is, or you can dump much of the content. Not necessarily perfectly, but you can get more or less what's in the file. And that just starts off with one of them is basically to expand it by using a encoding that will take every byte and just, you know, make it like 4 or 8 bytes or something. I forget exactly how that one went. But you would expand the file out so it would run out of memory, hit its memory limit, and then it's like, okay, we're done. And then you would combine that with a chunked encoding, so it would try to interpret the first bytes as hex characters, and you can determine whether or not the first character was a hex character on the base of whether or not that succeeds. If it succeeds, you won't, or it'll basically end up erroring out again because it doesn't follow like the chunked transfer encoding format, unless it just happens to, which is very unlikely. But when it doesn't, you won't have, it'll basically give you an empty string and you won't be able to expand that out. And so you can kind of determine that. And then they have some other encoding to kind of move characters around, shift around their bytes so they fit within that hex range. And you can leak different things based off of like do base 64 to reduce your range. And then you like raw 13 to get some in range and some not, and other encodings kind of like you figure things out. It gets really complex on the encodings, and eventually you can dump every character, and you could eventually get to dumping like not just the first character but other characters there. It gets really complicated. It was only used in a CTF. I've never seen this technique used on like a real app. I haven't heard of it being used on a real app, but it is an interesting thing that because it only requires the file open to be vulnerable, it might be hard to spot where you can use this, but it is something that's maybe worth keeping in mind, because the only primitive you need is it needs to open and read the file. It doesn't depend on actually having anything printed out for you, which does mean it is probably there. There are probably places you could use this. It's just, I don't think I've seen it. If any of you have, I would love to see a write-up using this sort of technique, because this is really cool. But I've never seen this used in the wild, and because of the complexity, I think both Spectre and I kind of agreed to just drop it, or he might not have read it yet, but before we end up dropping it from it. But that is why we kind of missed it, but it's at least an interesting idea because of the limited primitive that you need. But yeah, it is what it is. It is a bit hard to follow. This is, you know, maybe the better explanation of it, because I guess in 2022, there's another time it was documented, but people, or the comment here is that the community struggled to replicate it and it escaped attention, whereas now it's kind of a lot more in depth and explained better. So fair enough. Something to keep in mind for sure. SMTP smuggling. I think we just covered this. Yeah, on episode 233. So very recently. Very recently,
yeah.
Yeah, like within the last 10 episodes, I think. Because I think this is 243. Yes, we just covered it. That one had request smuggling, almost a request smuggling feel, because it took advantage of a desync between first proxy and second proxy. But with SMTP, where it's like your mail server and it's just kind of sending it between servers. So you'll send an SMTP message, then it'll send a very similar message to the actual recipient server, and using kind of the desync between the sending server that you initially send passed it to and the recipient one, using a desync there. So very similar to request smuggling, but a little bit different. Really cool. We talked about that on episode 233, so you can kind of get more in depth there. Exploiting hardened .NET serialization. We tend to skip when it comes to deserialization topics in general. This one's no different. I mean, most of the time when we skip them, it's because it's just a source to sync issue. It goes, you have a source that goes into a deserialize. It's the same thing, like every time. Coming up,
there's
with
not
your
much variation in the vulnerabilities generally.
Yeah. On the attack strategies, there is a lot, but it tends to be very focused on your specific target.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what happens here. They do find. So I would have largely looked over this. I don't think it really even crossed my path. It might have. Like, I mean, the name is kind of generic, so it's hard to say if I remember reading it or not. But they do hit on a few different primitives that maybe wouldn't normally be covered, like an SSRF primitive out of the deserialization. At least what they present here is a few new gadgets that, you know, could be weaponized, because what they're dealing with here is a hardened .NET deserialization, which is just a block list space. You can't do these objects. Ideal case is always whitelisting, but in the case of deserialization, like a lot of apps want to support arbitrary objects, and therefore they allow a lot of things, and you're just kind of racing to find things that aren't blacklisted yet, and that's what they went about here. Definitely some interesting. This is massive. It's like 100 pages. They have a lot to it. So if you're getting into the deserialization, how to kind of, I mean, maybe not how to hunt, but some ideas for what to look for. It actually seems pretty solid for that. So you can check it out. Not some that we're going to be able to cover in depth at 100 pages either. They have a lot in here. So there's a lot of value if you're getting into that. And that is one of the harder things. It's finding your own gadgets. A lot of people just depend on like WISO serial and other tools that will generate your payloads. You know, actually kind of doing it manually is just, you have to sit through the code. You have to look through it and do that work. It can be hard, but it's also pretty rewarding when you do get like a deserialization chain kind of working in your specific target that's otherwise hardened. You know, I've had to do it a handful of times. Not a ton, but, you know, it can be challenging, but it is a rewarding thing to go through. But also because it tends to be so focused on your target, not necessarily something we can cover too well. Last one, I absolutely agree with this being number one for the year, smashing the Stave Machine, True Potential of Web race conditions. You've listened to us for any amount of time. You've heard me talk about race conditions. I love race conditions on the web. It's one of my favorite attack classes, has been for a while. And this is just moving it forward, moving the research into a new area, looking for smaller races, giving ideas on how to actually hunt for these, how to detect that they're happening, and a lot smaller than just your limit overrun issues, but going for just like those slight Stave Machine changes that maybe aren't ideally done transactionally, everything happens at once, but you might be able to take advantage of kind of when it makes multiple updates, and you might be able to take advantage of that middle state by racing for it. Some windows are bigger than others, really cool stuff. We actually did talk about this. I don't think I've got the episode that we talked about this, but I've referenced this research multiple times since this summer, and it would have been our first episode back from the summer.
I was going to say it happened while we were on break, so it would have been the first episode we had in September or whatever.
Yeah, it was. It was on that first episode back where I would have talked about this because it was like the one DEF CON presentation. I'm like, I'm going to this one. I need to go see this one. So it was kind of like the research I was also most excited for to see this year. Although a lot of these posts, as I've said, are really solid. And I actually, let me figure out what episode number we came back on.
While you do that, I'll just say it was kind of funny to read number one, smashing the Stave Machine, and they're like, oh, well, this is awkward. I always knew there was a risk of rating research when I also published it myself, and after 7 years it happened. And making a bit of a joke about, declaring their own research as the best.
I mean, definitely kind of no
funny,
bias but
it's
here.
Definitely, yeah, I mean, it's kind of funny, and, you know, it's fun to joke about, but, like, legitimately, that research was very impactful, and as you said, I don't think it's up for debate at it being the number one spot. And they include a quote from the panel as well that kind of says pretty much the same thing, so...
Yeah, no, it's solid research. I mean, you can maybe argue about there being a bias because this is Portswigger's top 10 web hacking techniques. And of course, you know, it's more likely to be recommended something that's come from Portswigger than just random posts on the internet that didn't get much attention. Nonetheless, I definitely agree there. And it looks like I would have talked about this on episode 215. So if you want to go back and find that, we just had the summer recap. So I would have talked about some. Unfortunately, we don't have the exact timestamp for it. We started our summer recap 11 minutes or 12 minutes in, and we ended it 50 minutes in, but it looks like it was the last thing talked about, or at least it's the last link we've got. Unfortunately, that only narrows it down to like a 40-minute window for you to find, but
granularity isn't quite that fine.
Yeah, it could be, actually. Like, we could improve that, but since it was kind of under a larger topic, we only have timestamps for the bigger topic. Nonetheless, I mean, if you read the post for it, the post, you know, explains everything in the presentation. The post is really good, and that's probably what I recommended people do at the time is, you know, take a look at the post itself because, you know, it goes more in depth, I think, than the presentation itself did.
Yeah, presentations, you're always kind of limited on how in-depth you can go before you kind of lose people, whereas you don't have that problem so much with the post, so it's generally a better reference point.
Yeah, and I'll be honest, I more or less don't disagree with anything here. I mean, ordering, you know, you can argue about. I kind of just take this whole thing as, like, a list of things, not really, like,
you don't
this
care
one's
about the
better
order
than this
too,
one.
Too
yeah.
Much.
Yeah, but I think this is a good selection, a good representation of the year. And yeah, a lot of interesting stuff. Like any of these posts, you know, has something you can, or almost any of these posts has something you can learn from.
Yeah, and I mean, especially with web, they kind of stated here too, like 2023 saw the security community publish a huge quantity of quality research. So it can be hard to sift through everything to get what's really good to look at for your own research. So just like collating these links together into a top 10 provides a lot, you know, centralizes everything for you. And it's a really good idea. And, you know, they've been doing it for a while and hopefully we'll do it for a while to come.
I have the nomination list that you can check out from when they were taking nominations, which will have some other good topics in there too. But yeah, there are some good post just in the nomination list to take a look at, but of course nomination list is going to have a little bit more noise but at least someone out there thought these were worth nominating.
Yeah. All right, so we'll get into some of our shoutouts of the episode. So we have a post by JMSWRNR. I'm not going to try to flow that. I don't know if it really does. But yeah, so they have a post on exploiting an air purifier that uses an ESP32. So it's a smart device, but of course, like, it has a mobile app for controlling it, which needs a cloud account. It can't be done through Bluetooth or Wi-Fi. It has to go through WAN, which I guess it's par for the course for IoT. Why make things simple when you can route through the cloud? But it kind of got them thinking, like, what can you do if you get into a man-in-the-middle position where you can intercept traffic to and from the device? So they did some reversing of the app and the protocol underneath it. There's a lot of in-depth detail they go into on reversing the protocol, because ultimately it was like UDP based and it did employ encryption for the packet data. Not all of it was encrypted. There was like a header and whatnot, but yeah, so they had to go through, reverse some of the firmware to figure out what the protocol was there, because it wasn't a standard like DTLS or anything like that. It was a custom scheme, but ultimately that custom scheme, you know, as the saying always goes, don't implement your own crypto. The problem here was that they had common private keys. So as soon as you were able to pull the private key as an attacker from one firmware, you could pretty much use that to man in the middle multiple devices. And there's also no signing or integrity enforcement on the firmware here. There was a checksum, but of course, you know, that's not security. So they were able to straight up modify the firmware, update the checksum, and boot it. And with that combination of live analysis and reversing, we're able to reverse that protocol and such. So, yeah, I mean, the issue here isn't super exciting, but I think the process they went through of reversing the protocol is pretty interesting. It is sort of its own art that isn't talked about too much. Like, I feel like a lot of people ask, like, how do you reverse this kind of network data? So this post can give you some inspiration on that. And like I said, it's kind of its own art. So it's cool to get some insight into that. But where most of this post is more of that reversing, especially on, you know, the bounty episode, we didn't want to cover that too much. But I still want to give it a shout out because there's definitely some value in that post.
Yeah, and as a post, this is very long in terms of the process, what they went through to get there, all the way through this from, you know, the network inspection, but also like the physical aspect of it, just super in depth and kind of covering this as, you know, someone who's a beginner to WallFit could follow through a lot of this, gets in like the Ghidra setup, so you're not needing to go by IDA to follow along.
Yeah.
Gets into the crypto. The crypto analysis, you know, isn't super in depth there. It's just more the crypto code and what it's doing, explaining that.
It's the implementation, not the algorithms and stuff itself, really.
Yeah.
Beyond just the fact that they're used.
Yeah. And I will just really quickly mention the URL of JMSWRNR. It's James Warner or Warner. That's his name. So.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah. I went fair to enough. The about page to check that out. Yeah. That makes a lot more sense. And you can say that one. Yeah, sometimes we forget. But yeah, as a post, like, you know, vulnerability here is meh, but there's so much information here if you want to get looking at IoT devices that would just be applicable to take a look at and consider.
Yeah. And speaking on the crypto aspect, we also have a shout out from Trail of Bits on cloud cryptography. So again, this post doesn't really go into crypto in the sense of like all the maths and heavy stuff on that, but rather how it's used. If you're not into cloud, like I'm not really into cloud, some of this may not be super obvious as to what they're talking about, but it's sort of talking about where you can map different use cases to different scenarios, like when to use HSM and when to use the key management service and things like that. Especially if you are not super familiar with how crypto should be used in the cloud, I think this post can offer a lot of value to you.
Yeah, and it is fairly simple, just straightforward. Just here are these different services that exist within AWS. Crypto related, how they could be used, super high level stuff there, but you know, you don't necessarily know ahead of time exactly how these things can be used. Maybe you're familiar with what a secrets manager is, maybe you're not, but they at least kind of try to explain all these different services that are there and where you might want to use them. Again, not super in depth, but it is one of those kind of cloud services that it kind of exists in that place where if you know, you know, like, you know what you need when you're working with this, but if you want to get into that or look at it, it's a little bit more opaque to understand.
You're relying on somebody else's experience, and that's kind of what this is trying to relay. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's just high level. Look at that. I figured it was worth shouting out, but no vulnerabilities or anything here. It's just peer services.
Yeah. It's how just to avoid vulnerabilities, in fact.
Perhaps sort of. A bit of that. I think you can still have issues. Like, they don't really get into a lot of that. It's just about them, but it is one of those more opaque areas, especially with the naming of some AWS services. You know, it helps, I think. So I figured it was worth at least shouting it out as, you know, just this high level overview.
Yeah, basically trying to say like how to do the crypto properly. That's what I was getting at there. All right, but yeah, that's all the topics we have for this episode. So as always, thanks goes out to everyone who tuned in. Feel free to join the community by joining our Discord and Twitter. The links for those are in the description. And as we said at the top of the show, if you have some links that you want to drop that you think should be covered or whatever, or just find interesting in general, because we like to read that stuff. So yeah, feel free to leave it in the Discord. And with that said, we'll see you next time.